This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today's primary election is unlike any other most of us have experienced. Some of us voted by mail for the first time. Or if you're headed to your traditional polling place, the Indiana National Guard has been helping to deliver PPE to counties for weeks in preparation. Meanwhile, candidates have been trying to figure out how they can earn your vote from home. Here to catch us up on what protocol at the polls will look like today, who is on the ballot, and when we can anticipate results is Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Brandon, thanks for being with us today.
Always happy to join you.
So let's start with what voters headed to traditional polling places today can expect in regards to procedure and safety protocol. State officials and polling locations have had about a month now from the original election date to prepare. How is this voting experience going to be different from what we know it to be?
Functionally, the difference that Hoosier voters should see, and I emphasize should, is that poll workers should be wearing masks and gloves. For sure, they should be wearing masks. The state has been working with the National Guard and suppliers to get the now ubiquitous PPE to counties across the state for their poll workers. And the Election Commission and guidance from the state, I should say, guidance from the Secretary of State's office who handles elections in this state, is about wearing the mask at all times when you're at the poll, when you're working the polls, cleaning and disinfecting things regularly. So that's surfaces, both on the voting machines and on tables and elsewhere, washing hands frequently, having access to hand sanitizer. That's what people will see that is obviously very different from the typical election day.
And do voters who arrive have to wear a mask?
They do not. That was also in the guidance sent to all of the county election administrators. And it emphasizes very clearly that while, you know, for instance, businesses can require you to wear a mask before they allow you in their store, the same cannot be said for the polling place. That it is the opinion of the state's the heads of the Indiana Election Division, the bipartisan heads, a Republican attorney, a Democratic attorney, believe that to require someone to wear a mask or to wear gloves or to use hand sanitizer or to wash their hands or observe the 6-foot social distancing guidelines in order to vote would violate their constitutional right to vote. So while it's a good idea if you're wearing a mask and observing social distancing as much as possible, it is not required.
Now, what about the kinds of protocols that are in place in, you know, under normal circumstances? Now we've got this sort of wrench in the gears of, you know, COVID-19 and those protocols. And like you said, it's kind of sensitive as to whether or not people should be required to wear them. But so if someone does come in and is wearing a mask, that mask, I would assume, can't have any positive or negative, political message on it, or can it? Do you know anything about that?
I do. That was also part of the guidance. So that, it's kind of an extension of the normal procedures. So Indiana, what's called electioneering law, has long said that you can't come into a polling place as a voter or whomever else with a big shirt that says, you know, I support all Republicans, I support all Democrats, or Joe for Congress, or don't vote for Smith for state representative or something like that. That extends to those face masks or face coverings. So similarly, like you just said, you can't have a face mask or face covering that advocates for or against a candidate, an elected official, or a party. If you were to come in, you would be expected to be asked to remove that face covering. So if you do want to wear a mask, and again, it's a good idea to wear a mask, certainly at a polling place as well as anywhere in public where you're going to be around other people, please don't wear one that would violate those electioneering laws. And again, that's not something new. It's just an extension of a longstanding what's called electioneering law.
All right, let's talk about vote by mail, which was expanded to any registered voter who wanted to do so in this election. And indeed, you reported that over 500,000 Hoosiers, nearly 550,000 Hoosiers requested absentee ballots, a major increase from years prior. But there have been concerns about an overloaded U.S. Postal Service being able to deliver all of those absentee ballots to county election offices on time. What is the deadline, and how big of a concern is this?
It's a big concern in certain parts of the state, for sure, to start with. The deadline has already passed. So as we sit here a little after the 1 o'clock hour in Indianapolis time, or in Eastern time, the deadline was noon at your county election administrator's office. And now there were a few ways you could do that. Obviously, you could put it in the mail. You could also hand deliver it to your county election administrator's office if you were worried about the mail not getting it there on time. But if you didn't get that absentee vote by mail ballot in by noon on election day, that doesn't count. Now, fortunately, there are some other things you could do if that became a problem for you. You can still vote in person, for instance. If you didn't submit your absentee vote by mail ballot, if you didn't mail it back or get it to your county election administrator, you can go to the polling places. There's a form you'd have to fill out that essentially void, not essentially, it voids your absentee ballot. So the system will show that, okay, well, they didn't use the absentee ballot. They voted in person instead. There's also a procedure for, let's say you got your absentee ballot very late in the process and you put it back in the mail, but you're really worried. Let's say you put it in the mail on Saturday and you're really worried that it's not going to get to the office, that it didn't get to the office by election day at the deadline. What you can do in that case is you can go to your polling place and explain the situation. And there's another form you can fill out that voids that one, that says if it comes in later or something, that yes, they tried to turn it in, but if it came in beyond the deadline, that doesn't count. We're going to void that, and what counts is you voting in person, the ballot you fill out at the polling place. But fortunately, if you go to the polling place and your ballot did get to them by mail in time, the system would show that, and they'll let you know, and you'll know that your vote was counted.
We're talking to Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith about the primary election, which is happening today, a month after it would have under normal circumstances. But because of the pandemic, it was moved, as so many other states have done. Not all states, though. And Brandon, one of the examples of this possibly not going as well as it should, or even as well as it could, is the Marion County clerk, Maya Eldridge. She sent a letter last week to state officials asking for that deadline to be extended, the deadline around mail-in ballots. What was behind her request?
First of all, she is facing the by far the highest number of absentee ballot requests in the state, in any single county, which makes sense. Marion County has the highest population, the highest number of registered voters, so logically, the highest number of absentee ballots. And she was concerned because, quite frankly, they were still sending mail-in ballots out to voters a little over a week before the election. So what she's concerned about is people, the ballot getting to the person and then being able to mail it back in time. And so what she's worried about is that she's going to get an influx of absentee ballots after that noon election day deadline that she simply cannot count. It is a very real concern. And she addressed that that concern was raised by more than Myra Eldridge before now, or Myla Eldridge, excuse me, before now. Democrats on the Indiana Election Commission tried to extend that noon election day deadline multiple times over the last couple of months. They tried to extend it to 2 or 3 days after the election. They tried to extend it to just the ballot had to be postmarked by election day. So a sign that it was processed in time but didn't physically get to the county election office. And it should be noted that the election commission's changing of all the deadlines said that counties have until June 12th to finish counting all of their absentee ballots. But Republicans, when Democrats tried to change the deadline at least a little bit, Republicans just said no. And there was never really a public explanation for why they did that. Now, Secretary of State Connie Lawson asked about it just last week, said, well, it's about safety and security. But no explanation has been given as to why, say, that if the ballot was postmarked on election day, it could be valid, is less secure than getting to it by noon on election day.
Mm. Okay, and let's come back to this part. Let's say someone is worried whether their mail-in ballot arrived on time. You know, the noon deadline is passed at this point. What again can that person do if they're worried that that their precinct didn't get their ballot?
Right. Well, if they already put it in the mail, there's two things they can do. One, if you go online to indianavoters.com, which is where you can check your registration, look at your sample ballot, and where this year, for the first time, you could apply with one form to get an absentee vote by mail ballot sent to you by your county election administrator. If you go on there and you go to your voter portal, there's a section about absentee ballots, and it will say when you requested it, when it was mailed to you, and if it was received. If you go on to indianavoters.com, into your voter portal, and you can and you see, oh, they got my ballot, then you're all set. If you don't see that there, what you can do is you can go to your polling place, like normal, in person, say to them, listen, I sent in my absentee ballot. I'm worried it's not going to get there on time. I'd like to vote. You fill out a form that voids your absentee ballot and accepts your in-person ballot that you do at the polling place.
Hmm. All right. In the last minute that we have in this segment, we're going to just kind of preview the discussion that is yet to come. So let's turn to a few of the races that have been on people's radar. And one of the most notable has been that race for attorney general. In about 30 seconds, can you talk about what the attorney general's job description is?
Very briefly, the Indiana Attorney General is the highest legal officer in the state. So the AG's office defends the state in court. That is perhaps the biggest thing or the most high-profile thing that the office does. So if somebody sues the state over a state law or something like that, the AG's office will defend. On all appeals of any case in the state, the AG's office takes over defending that during the appeals process. They can also take over in local matters if the county requests it and things like that. There's other things they do in terms of consumer protection and things like that, but defending the state in court is probably the biggest and most high-profile thing the office does.
And indeed, it is a high-profile race on this primary day here in Indiana. We are talking with Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith about the primary election, and we'll continue this conversation with Brandon after the break, and we'll talk more about Curtis Hill and the race for Indiana Attorney General. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with that in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about the primary election. Some are at the polls. Some have already cast their ballots via mail-in voting. And we're not taking live calls and comments today, but we would love to hear your thoughts on what this election has been like for you. Did you vote differently than you normally would have? Was it more challenging for you to feel engaged with candidates? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana and let us know. We're joined again by Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. And Brandon, when we left off, we were talking about the attorney general race. And in order to talk about the broader race, let's just get an update on the status of the current Attorney General, Curtis Hill. So last month, the Indiana Supreme Court suspended his license for 30 days after it concluded he criminally battered four women in 2018. And one of the major questions at hand when this ruling came down was whether or not an attorney general with a suspended law license could continue to be the attorney general. Has this question been resolved?
No.
In short, no.
The governor tried to ask the Supreme Court to answer that question. He did so by filing a motion. This is going to get a little technical, but the technicality is important here because that's what the Supreme Court relied on. The governor tried to insert himself into the disciplinary case itself, wherein the Supreme Court handed down that 30-day suspension of Curtis Hill's law license. And what the Supreme Court said is that, well, he can't do that. The governor can't interfere in this disciplinary case. The disciplinary action is concluded. It's done. It's finished. we won't even answer the question. So they just punted entirely on it. Now, there have been multiple lawsuits filed by Hoosier citizens in Marion County and Elkhart County asking the question again, which is they put forward the belief that this says that, you know, by suspending his law license for even 30 days, it creates a vacancy in the office. And if a vacancy is created in the office, state law says the governor gets to fill it. And that's very different from what has already happened in this case. We haven't really seen those cases move. And with the 30-day clock ticking, I'm not sure anything's going to happen when it comes to Curtis Hill. The Supreme Court might eventually have to answer this question, but the greater likelihood is that if and when they do, it'll be about any potential future instances and not the one we're in right now.
And so, as far as today's primary election goes, voters won't be directly choosing between candidates for attorney general on their ballots, right? Can you talk about how that selection process works?
Correct. Like other state offices, including Secretary of State, State Department of Education, when that was an elected position, Treasurer, Auditor, they don't have a public primary the way governor and U.S. Senator do in Indiana. Instead, the nominees for attorney general for each major political party are chosen by delegates at the state party conventions, which are coming up here in just a couple of weeks for the Democrats and the Republicans. Now, voters can choose the delegates to those conventions, which is important because the delegates will be voting on those nominees, but they can't directly choose the nominees themselves for the attorney general.
And so who then are those candidates that the Republican delegates are going to be choosing between?
Sure. Well, there's Curtis Hill, the incumbent, obviously.
Sure.
John Westerkamp, who is a private attorney in the Indianapolis area, he entered the race last year. He was the first challenger to Curtis Hill to enter the race. Young, not very well known by the public, certainly. He's never held elected office, but, certainly active in Republican circles for years. Nate Harder, who is the Decatur County prosecutor, was a late entrant into the race, which surprised some people because he is, by all accounts, a Curtis Hill disciple. He has represented the attorney general at Republican dinners around the state over the last several months. He actually was technically the one who nominated Curtis Hill at the convention 4 years ago. So he is in lockstep with Curtis Hill, except right now where he says, Curtis Hill needs to go, essentially. And then a very, very, very late entrant into the race, which is to say a day before the deadline to enter, was former Congressman and Secretary of State Todd Rokita. By far the biggest name other than Curtis Hill in the race. He's been active in Republican Party politics in Indiana for two decades now. In addition to being an elected official, he's since leaving office in 2018, he's been active on the local dinner and fundraiser circuit. And so he's put himself forward to be attorney general as well on the Republican side.
Okay. And so is there, I guess, a decent enough chance that Curtis Hill may be unseated by one of these three gentlemen? I guess, are there any favorites that stand out for the nomination?
If it's not Curtis Hill, the smart money's on Todd Rokita. He's got the name. He's got the apparatus within the party dating back two decades. It would make the most sense if Curtis Hill doesn't get renominated that it's Todd Rokita who is the one to unseat him. But I'm choosing not. Well, I've been saying for a while that I thought Curtis Hill would not only be renominated, but reelected as attorney general. Hmm. That's just my personal view of covering politics in the state for a decade. Todd Rokita getting into the race changes that dynamic significantly because he is such a heavy hitter in the party. But it is very difficult to predict what a state Republican Party or any state convention will do, Democrat or Republican, even harder to predict given the unusual nature of this year's conventions.
What are some of the arguments you've heard for nominating Curtis Hill?
Put rather simply, Curtis Hill says all of this was trumped up against him. All of the sexual assault, the sexual misconduct allegations were false. They were trumped up. It was a conspiracy by the sort of establishment in Indianapolis, which he would include the governor in, against him, and that you should ignore all of that and vote for him anyway.
And
beyond that, I don't know what the argument is. I will say, policy-wise, there is no difference between these four candidates. As office holders, they will do the same things. It's only about the differentiation they are trying to make is about the Supreme Court saying that Curtis Hill sexually assaulted or criminally battered, I should say, four women.
All right, let's look to November with regard to the attorney general race. Whoever it is among these four gentlemen, what about the Democratic side? Who's seeking the nomination on that side?
That's State Senator Karen Tallien, who's from the region, and a former Evansville Mayor Jonathan Weinzapfel. It'll be interesting to see that, again, really hard to predict where. Now, Weinzapfel has more money coming in. There's been a poll recently admittedly done by the Tallien campaign that says she's more likely to beat Curtis Hill. So, you know, take that with the usual grain of salt that you take internal campaign polling. So really hard to get a read on that one. But the chances of a Democrat being elected to the office are significantly better if Curtis Hill is the nominee. That Republicans have had a stranglehold on that office for two decades now, as they have most statewide offices. It's unlikely that that would change very much unless Curtis Hill's the one on the ballot.
Today is primary day in Indiana, and we are talking to our Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith about the big races that are on the ballot and ones that we may see in November and ones that will be dealt with at the convention later this year. And let's talk about that. So both the Democratic and Republican parties will be holding virtual conventions. What typically happens at these conventions, and what will that have to look like this year?
Well, there's a lot of things having to do with party platforms, so statements of beliefs by the party, and there have been some fights over that at both parties, notably at the Republican one in the last few years over same-sex marriage. But the biggest thing is that the delegates at that those conventions vote for those statewide elected officials. So this year, it's attorney general. In off-year elections, it's secretary of state, treasurer, and auditor. They also technically vote for, I shouldn't say technically, they'll also be voting for the lieutenant governor candidates in both parties, though this year, as in a lot of years, those are uncontested. So incumbent Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch on the Republican side and Linda Lawson, who's running with the Democratic gubernatorial candidate Woody Myers, are unopposed. So the voting is going to happen by mail. Now, on the Democratic side, that's pretty straightforward. There's two candidates. Delegates will get ballots in the mail. They say who they want to vote for attorney general, send them back in. Republicans, it's a little trickier because there are four candidates, and it's not a simple whoever gets the most votes system. The way convention voting works is there are, so for instance, if this were a normal election year, four candidates on the ballot on the Republican side for attorney general, you would have one round of voting. Whoever has the low, if a candidate gets 50% plus one of that vote, they are the nominee. But if they don't, as we saw just 4 years ago when there were multiple candidates for attorney general on the Republican side, they go to another round of voting. The person with the lowest number of votes drops off, and now their supporters can go vote for somebody else. And so you see at the when there's a convention in person, you see jockeying in place, deals being made among candidates who are now being eliminated and their supporters saying, okay, we're going to throw our support behind this person or that person. That sort of thing isn't going to happen the same way this year because those are vote by mail ballots. So what they're going to have to do on the Republican side is ranked choice voting. So let's say I want Curtis Hill to be the attorney general. He's my first choice. But if, say, Curtis Hill was knocked off the ballot, well, I want Todd Rokita to be my second choice, and Nate Harder my third, and John Westerkamp my fourth, or any permutation thereof. And so that's how they will choose their nominee this time around. It's a little different, a little confusing to some, but we'll see how it shakes out in the end. It's really hard to read what impact that will have, however.
All right, let's turn to the gubernatorial race. We have incumbent Eric Holcomb on the Republican ticket, and incumbents tend to do pretty well in Indiana. What do we know about his odds of reelection right now? And are there any signs that the pandemic has affected them at all, for better or for worse?
Well, again, with the enormous grain of salt that you use when evaluating partisan polling. So if a campaign does a poll, you take that with a huge grain of salt. But the Republicans just released a poll recently that suggests that Eric Holcomb has like a 79% approval rating, and he is very likely to be reelected, and that a strong majority of Hoosiers support, or Hoosiers in the poll support, the way he's handled the COVID-19 pandemic. Again, there's only so much you can read into polling done by a partisan group or a campaign, but that lines up with the sort of conventional wisdom of not only the state of Indiana in general, but also this race. There's no question Eric Holcomb has a huge advantage, not just as an incumbent, but as a Republican, and a Republican who hasn't done the sort of things to piss off voters, quite frankly, that, say, his predecessor did in Mike Pence. So there is no reason to think that Eric Holcomb doesn't have a huge advantage going into November.
And Governor Holcomb got an interesting endorsement from the Northwestern Indiana Building and Constructions Trade Council, an organization in Northwest Indiana that represents tens of thousands of union building trades workers. I say interesting because it's the first time the council has endorsed a Republican candidate for Indiana governor. What does an endorsement like that signal?
You know, we talked about this on my show, Indiana Week in Review, not to put in a plug, but to put in a plug.
Go for it.
And I asked Nikki Kelly, the State House reporter from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette, who's been covering politics in Indiana for about 20 years now, if this endorsement said more about Eric Holcomb or Democrat Woody Myers. And she thinks it says more about Woody Myers, which is he's not seen as a very strong candidate this time around, unfortunately, if for those of us who like competitive elections. And so it reflects a general sense that Eric Holcomb is likely going to be, very likely going to be reelected. But I stopped making really hard and fast predictions about politics 4 years ago. And in the middle of a global pandemic, I'm even more reticent to make a hard and fast prediction.
Probably a good idea. So let's talk about the candidate on the Democratic ticket, Woody Myers. State Senator Eddie Melton and Indianapolis Tech CEO Josh Owens were names that we heard about on the trail, but Myers is the only remaining candidate on the ticket on the Democratic side. Who is Woody Myers? What's his background?
Well, I'll say this, and I was just talking about this with some of my colleagues just the other day, and this was the thing I said, which was, for the time that we are living in right this second, Woody Myers would seem to be a tailor-made candidate for public office. He is a medical doctor who has spent his career working in the healthcare industry. He is a former state health commissioner. So, you know, in the middle of a global pandemic, someone you would go to as an expert. And he is also the first black man to ever be a candidate for governor on a major party ticket in Indiana. Right now, in the time we're living in, that feels like a really interesting candidate for governor. But he has not, as far as we can tell, generated a lot of excitement among Hoosiers. Now, he is hamstrung in that because obviously the global pandemic has curtailed the sort of campaigning that you normally do, especially since he's been the presumptive candidate for several months. So I'm not going to put it all on Woody Myers here, but there is dissatisfaction among many Hoosier Democrats that I'm aware of, that they feel like he's not a very exciting candidate, even though his bona fides really line up nicely with the issues that we'll be talking about this particular year. Mm.
And you mentioned earlier his pick for Lieutenant Governor Linda Lawson. Why did that pick make sense for him?
So Linda Lawson is a former state representative from the region, from Hammond. She now lives in Brown County in a rural part of the state. She's a woman, which has become a sort of checkmark that candidates choose the last few cycles in Indiana for lieutenant governor, apparently not good enough for governor, at least not the last few cycles. But she's also in law enforcement. She was the first female police officer in the Hammond Police Department. She rose to the level of captain, which is the first time a woman had ever done that. She led a sexual assault and domestic violence task forces. She's strong in education. She served on the school board up in the region as well. So she sort of balances out the ticket really nicely for Woody Myers. Also, personally speaking, I covered her for years at the State House. I challenge anyone to find a more exciting, interesting, fiery candidate than Linda Lawson.
Hmm. And what about campaigning in a pandemic? I mean, we did a whole show on this. There've got to be a lot of differences there.
Yeah, and that's something that every candidate on the ballot is having to kind of tackle. The normal grassroots campaigning that is necessary for you to do in most races in this state, going door to door, getting those calls out, are a lot harder to do. It's also a lot harder to raise money. One, people have a lot less of it right now for obvious reasons in the midst of the pandemic. But also if you can't do in-person fundraisers where you're gathering 100 and something people in a house, or at least a lot of places or a lot of people aren't willing to do that. So a lot of the sort of tried and true, this is how you run for office in the state of Indiana, things aren't really possible right now. So campaigns have to get creative, whether it's virtual town halls or, you know, Zoom meetings with constituents or whatever. You got to find ways to get to people that you normally could get to just by going door to door.
We are talking to Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith, and we will continue to talk about some of the big races that that you can vote for. There is still time to cast your ballot today because the polls are open. And a big thank you to all the poll workers, of course, who are helping to make that opportunity available to us today. We'll be back with Brandon in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today we're talking about the primary election. Some people are out at the polls. Some have cast their ballots already by mailing in their ballots. And we are talking with Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith about today's primary election and the big changes, of course, with the COVID-19 pandemic. And we were talking a little bit about Linda Lawson, the pick for lieutenant governor from Democratic candidate Woody Myers. And she is from the region, as you said. And speaking of the region, the first congressional district, it's one of the more high profile races in the state right now. Can you tell us a little bit about this district?
Yeah, it's one of the more high profile races in the primary. It will not be in the general election, unlike another congressional race that we're going to talk about in a second. And the reason it's so competitive in the primary on the Democratic side in particular, there are more than a dozen candidates running for that seat, is because it is as safe a Democratic seat as you are likely to find. Whoever wins the primary on the Democratic side will be the congressperson from that seat. And it's also very competitive because Pete Visklosky, the congressman who is retiring and opening that seat up, was in that seat for multiple decades. So it's the first time that anyone has been able to really run for it without challenging an incumbent in a long time. So as I said, there are more than a dozen candidates, and it's always hard to predict how a race like that will shake out because you could win the primary with like 20% of the vote because if it really gets diluted. And there's an interesting wrinkle this year in that with so many people voting by mail, you have way more opportunities for voters to sit down at their kitchen tables and research these candidates in a way that they often don't do and certainly don't necessarily have access to at the polling place itself. So you have a lot more time for people to dig into these people and these candidates and their profiles and all of that, which makes for a really interesting dynamic that I'm not sure we can accurately predict. That being said, it seems like late on, as we got closer to Election Day, the smart money, and I do emphasize in some cases money, because fundraising matters, smart money seemed to be going towards Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott. Now, he's a notable figure up in that region and has been for a long time. He's very outspoken. He's a journalist's dream. I won't say anything about whether or not that makes him a voter or a constituent's dream, but he's a journalist's dream, certainly, in terms of his willingness to say a lot about a lot. So he seemed to be the front runner going into Election Day. But again, a lot of folks in that race, and it's hard to see how that would shake out.
Well, an endorsement from Pete Visklosky could mean a lot for a candidate. Has he endorsed anybody?
He has, in fact, and it's not Tom McDermott, which makes Tom McDermott's status as a front runner even more interesting. He endorsed Frank Mervan Jr., who's an elected official up in that area. His father, Frank Mervan Sr., is a state senator. So Mervan is absolutely someone that you would keep an eye on as a possible winner of that seat. Mara Candelaria Reardon, who is a state representative from that area, is Latina, has endorsements from Latino groups, and is influential among that constituency. She's certainly someone to keep your eye on up there. But with so many candidates, it'll be really interesting to sort of read those results in hindsight and see what it might tell us.
Let's talk about another district that has a lot of eyes on it right now, the 5th Congressional District. But this is a very different area than the 1st District. What's the story here?
Yeah, so this is the one I was referencing when I said it will be interesting in the general election, too. This is not a safe seat for either party anymore. It is a generally suburban Indianapolis district, and it's one of those districts that Democrats at the national level have been targeting over the last couple of cycles as they see sort of politics changing in suburban areas. Now, it's still a little more red than other places we've seen around the country that have flipped from red to blue in the last cycle or two. But it's definitely a high-profile target for Democrats this time around, made even more so because incumbent Susan Brooks decided not to run again, which is why you have a relatively small number of Democrats as sort of the party has coalesced around one person. That's Christina Hale, former state representative, former Democratic lieutenant governor candidate in 2016. She's running in that seat for the Democrats against a couple of other people, including the last nominee from that district, Dee Thornton. But the party, the money is coalescing around Hale as they see a very winnable seat in the fall to flip. On the other side, for Republicans, you have just a ton of candidates. You have, again, I think it's like 14 or 15 folks on the ballot on the Republican side in that seat.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, but has Susan Brooks, who's leaving the seat, has she endorsed any of the 15 candidates?
I haven't seen an endorsement. Now, the caveat here being that I don't cover that race as closely as some of my colleagues do, but I feel like I would have seen it, and I didn't. So she's chosen not to endorse in that race. And it is a lot more wide open, I feel like, than the first has felt going into Election Day. My sense of the first district race and talking to folks who are covering it even more closely than I am is that things were trending for, like I said, Tom McDermott. Here, it feels a little more split between a few candidates, and that's State Senator Victoria Spartz, Beth Henderson, who, as far as I know, is not an elected official, so a relative newcomer to running for office, and then Carl Brizzi, who was a prosecutor in this state. That seems to be the three names that I'm hearing the most as we got closer to Election Day, but there are a lot of candidates, including the state treasurer, Kelly Mitchell, who a lot of people thought would kind of be like the establishment mainstream Republican Party candidate. And even if she is, it doesn't seem like she's getting the kind of traction that the others are getting. Spartz, notably, has been on the air the most. Ads on TV, on the radio, lawn signs, you know, billboards, things like that. She's been out there the most in terms of getting her name out on the air leading up to this. And that could be the sort of thing that tips the scales.
Yeah, I guess us being in the situation that we're in, that could certainly help. So what then is your sense on how much the pandemic has affected this particular race in the 5th district? Have any candidates been arguably disadvantaged or perhaps benefited from the campaigning circumstances?
Yeah, so if you have a lot of money going in, which Victoria Spartz has loaned herself quite a bit of money in the campaign, for her campaign, that helps because you have the money to spend at a time when fundraising has become more difficult. If you were hoping to get a sort of grassroots, you know, surge as a candidate, which again, in a race with more than a dozen people, you can absolutely do, not being able to go door to door and just work your butt off on the campaign trail has made that a lot harder. It's just harder to connect with people right now in a lot of ways. So, yeah, I'm not sure I could say one candidate has been disadvantaged more than another necessarily in that realm. But certainly if you have some money to go with you, built-in money to go with you, it goes a long way right now when a lot of folks are just trying to figure out how to campaign.
Yeah, and so with that problem and with Victoria Spartz really spending some money, I mean, I've seen her name all around town. Of course, I live in Indianapolis. And so when you get closer to that fifth district, you start to see signs out and things like that. And hers is a name that I've seen a lot. With the circumstances, does it seem like in your years of covering politics, does it seem like we might get a surprise in the fifth district, or do you see it going to her or someone else with a little bit more name recognition?
Yeah, really hard to gauge. I think a lot of how we are going to evaluate this election will be done in hindsight. Yeah. We will look at the results after they come in and go, okay, how does that line up with the situation in hand, and what can that tell us about the future? Even if this might be the only election of its kind, although we might be headed for a similar one in November.
All right. We are talking with Brandon Smith. He's our State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. And we're talking about today's primary. Brandon, any other races that you're keeping your eyes on?
Nothing jumps out to me necessarily, though it is the primary. So you have slightly less interesting races there. There are incumbents in the State House, which I covered, that are being challenged, as they always are. There's a couple of open seats that I'm interested in, particularly the race to replace Brian Bosma, the Speaker of the House, which is a Northeast Indianapolis and suburban area district. So what I'll be looking for is just incumbents who lose. And again, in the pandemic, you wonder if there's perhaps more of a chance at that than usual, because you can't campaign like you normally do. And while you have, as an incumbent, the built-in name recognition, and that's going to go a long way, you also, again, have that wrinkle of people able to research these races more than perhaps they ever have before. Could that create some upsets? It's a very real possibility. So rather than one or two races in particular that I'm watching for, are there any real surprises? Are there incumbents who go down that we didn't see coming? And can that be attributed to the pandemic?
Yeah, it'll be really, really interesting to hear the numbers crunchers after all this is said and done and the dust settles. So aside from candidates, there are also referendum proposals on ballots across the state. And our education reporter, Jeannie Lindsay, reports that today's primary has the most school funding measures on the ballot since 2010. But are there concerns, I guess, about the viability of these proposals in the middle of a pandemic when so many people have lost their jobs and maybe aren't willing to shell out more money to taxes?
Absolutely. It's a twofold problem. One, you just mentioned it right there, which is if I've lost my job, if I've been furloughed, if I'm staring or looking unemployment in the face, perhaps in the coming weeks or months, yeah, I'm less likely to say, sure, take more of my money. But at the same time, schools can also use that to their advantage, which is we already really needed this money bad. We're about to need it a heck of a lot more. Please, please, please help us out. So it's kind of that push and pull there. But the other problem is, and this was pointed out in the reporting that Jeannie Lindsay did, credit to her, and because I hadn't thought about this issue, but of course, once you hear about it, it makes a lot of sense. These referendums are tax rates. So you're voting to increase slightly the tax rate on you in your area where you live, in that school district. Well, if property taxes take a nosedive, as they often do during a recession, and boy, it sure looks like we're heading into recession, or we might be at least, if we're not already in one. If property taxes take a dive, well, that increase isn't going to get you as much money as you thought it would, and so it's not going to get you as much money as the school thought it needed. So even for those who are successful, while it will be better than not, it might not be as good as they hoped it would be because of these factors that are out of everybody's control.
Are there particular referendum proposals that might stand, I guess, to do better than others, even in a moment like this? Like you said, it seems like schools could use this moment as an excuse to say, hey, look, we really need this.
It's difficult to predict school referenda lately. If you look at the statistics, as I do from time to time before an election, they're really interesting to see which ones get accepted and which ones don't. It's hard to read patterns necessarily all the time into that. I will say this, because this was pointed out, not to, boy, go two for two on plugs for my show, Indiana Week in Review, but we did just talk about this issue last week's show, and my colleague John Schwanis brought up the point that there is a school referendum proposal in, I believe, New Albany. That's the second one of its kind in Indiana, which is a newly created school safety referendum. So the dollars they are trying to get from the voters in that public question are specifically for school safety measures, school safety, whether it's equipment, personnel, whatever. And again, conventional wisdom is that people are more willing to pay for school safety than they might be for other things. Again, it's only the second one of its kind, so it's hard to look back into the past and to predict the future. But that might be one, as he mentioned, and I happen to agree with him, where voters might be a little more persuaded to support it, even in a time when they're watching their pocketbooks pretty closely.
Well, conventional wisdom, is there data behind that, though? I know that Carmel, Indiana, did a school safety referendum this past November, and that's a particularly Republican district. Did that pass?
It did, although generally Republican versus Democratic school districts don't matter that much in terms of the success of referenda across the state. Hmm. So it's hard to read into that. And again, there's not a lot of this is only the second school safety referendum that we've ever seen in Indiana. So we can't say that the Carmel result really will tell us much about how New Albany will do. If it is successful, or perhaps successful by a greater margin than some of the other school referendums we see this cycle, we might be able to infer that people are just a little more willing to shell out for school safety than they are for just school expenses in general.
Uh-huh. Now let's talk about when we will get the word back. I can tell you, and I think you were looped in on these conversations, so this is a little bit of inside baseball, but when we were talking about doing live coverage of this primary, we ultimately decided against it because we are not going to know any winners tonight. And so why would we do that? Do we know, because of the major shift to mail-in voting, when we can reasonably anticipate to get results back to find out who was nominated?
Yeah, succinctly put, not Tuesday night, not tonight. In most parts of the state. Now, Connie Lawson was asked about this very issue. Secretary of State Connie Lawson was asked about this very issue in recent weeks. And she pointed to some counties where they didn't have a lot of absentee ballots. In fact, Ohio County is the county with that sent out the least number of vote-by-mail ballots in this election. I think it was like 141 ballots. That's it. That's the only vote-by-mail that was being done in Ohio County, which is a small county, low number of registered voters. So they will probably have results Tuesday night. Marion County, there were more than 124,000 absentee ballots sent out. Don't expect results on election night. Connie Lawson said it could be 2 or 3 days. That's a reasonable expectation for, I think, most, if not almost all of the state. Marion County, the biggest counties that have the highest number of absentee ballots mailed back in, that could take a little bit longer depending on how the counting goes. And some of this is getting people to physically do the counting, which we know that there are issues with as people, you know, getting poll workers and things like that in the middle of a pandemic, particularly as poll workers tend to be older. And those are the folks that need to worry the most about being out and around other people right now. The only thing I'll say is there is a deadline. The Indiana Election Commission, as it normally does, set deadlines for when the counting of absentee ballots has to be completed. This time around, with the new deadlines, it is June 12th. So at the very least, I can guarantee we will know what the results are by Friday, June 12th at noon.
All right. And in the last less than a minute that we have, if we don't live in the first district or the fifth district, would you say that this is a particularly exciting primary?
Not for the sort of traditional big ticket items. The presidential primary, there is technically more than one Republican candidate. There are several Democrats on the ballot for president. But we already know who those candidates are going to be. It's going to be Joe Biden. It's going to be obviously incumbent Donald Trump. Beyond that, there are no other statewide races. There are a few congressional races, like we said, of note. But if you care about local races, that's the ones that make a difference, particularly as the General Assembly has gotten more and more polarized. It's the primaries where a lot of these districts are decided because the general election is less competitive. So if you care about your state representative and you want to either vote them in or vote them out, the primary is a lot of times the best chance you have to do that.
Brandon Smith is Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter, and we've been talking about the Indiana primary, which is today. Brandon, thank you as always.
Happy to do it.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. We are on social media at All in Indiana on Facebook and Twitter. Adam Gross is our technical director. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In.